Welcome back. It used to be the dream of many a child was to run away and join the circus. These days, maybe not so much. But for a former Clayton High School student, that's kind of what he did. His name is Duncan Wall. He became enamored of the circus while a student in Paris. He even took a few lessons in how to become an acrobat. But now, in what was probably a wise career choice, he is teaching circus history and related subjects in Canada. And he's writing about his interest. The result of it all is his book, The Ordinary Acrobat, and we talked earlier this week, and I welcomed him home.
Thank you. It's good to be home.
Do you get here often?
I do, yeah. I come back at least once or twice a year, yeah.
But you're in Montreal now, right?
I'm based in Montreal at the National Circus School up there.
And teaching circus history.
Teaching circus history and aesthetics. So it's actually how to think about the circus as a creative and constructive discipline as well.
Well, what in the world got a Clayton youngster interested in the circus?
It was a surprise to me, too. I was studying abroad in college. It was my junior year. I was doing a program actually for cinema and philosophy over there. Up to that point, I had done some theater. I'd also done a lot of sports. And so when they took us to see a contemporary circus as part of this program, I was blown away. It was nothing like I'd ever experienced as far as the circus goes, or really as far as anything goes theatrically.
What was it specifically about it that blew you away?
It was, so having said that I come from a background, a kind of an artistic background and also a sports background, it was the fact that I felt like I found in an art form those two things combined. It was at once visceral. It was also beautiful. It was also intelligent. There were acrobats doing double backflips. They were quoting Proust. They were singing Simon and Garfunkel. They were wrestling with each other, throwing each other. I mean, I just felt like I was seeing a piece of theater that I understood to be entirely theatrical. Like I knew why we were there to see this piece of theater, as opposed to watching it on a TV, for instance, or in a movie.
Proust and Simon and Garfunkel. That does sound like a circus.
Right. Exactly. It's like every circus you've ever seen. Right. No, it's completely unique.
What is it at the circus that we don't see? You know, we are all aware of everything that's going on, particularly in the three-ring circuses, but what don't we see when we go to the circus?
It's interesting. It's a complex question. I think it depends on the type of circus that you're seeing. I would say that one of the interesting things about the traditional circus, or what's called the conventional or traditional circus, the circus such as we know it and kind of in the iconography with the ringmaster and the three rings, et cetera, is that what happened behind the tent was actually as fascinating to people as what happened in the ring. So there actually wasn't all that much that you didn't, quote, see, because there was such a fascination with the circus life and with people as they existed as circus performers, not just as people in the ring, not just as stars, right? What you don't see in terms of the circus in general is all of the work, of course, like the years and years and years of training. The circus specifically, and of course it's true for any art form, there's a kind of craft that one has to develop. But with the circus, the craft is obviously physical. It's in your body, and it takes a lot of failure, and that failure is very, again, physical and brutal. So, I mean, now as somebody who's gone through some of that training, which I recount in the book, it's interesting for me to go to a show and see somebody do something that looks actually quite simple and easy and kind of feel my jaw drop and think, oh my gosh, that's so much work.
You know, the American movies over the years have given us the impression that there certainly is a lot of talent in this circus and people who are very well trained, but that it's kind of a seedy life as well. Is that an accurate portrayal?
It's to an extent it's accurate historically. Like the circus in America and around the world had some down periods. It also had some very, very high periods. One of the periods I like to write about in the book and talk about is in 19th century Paris, where actually the circus was a high art form on the level of ballet or opera. It was, you know, the building you would go to a circus in something like an opera house. You would attend in your tuxedo. Everybody would all dressed up. The biggest, most important diplomats would all go. They would have crushes on the riders. And the riders, it was an equestrian art form. So the riders would all be in tutus on the horses. That, you know, obviously it changed. It changes according to the cultural circumstances that surround the circus. During the mid-20th century, the circus went through a hard period. Cinema came in, television. It became harder and harder for circus performers to make a living and for circus to survive. That led to kind of a commercial exigencies that led the circus into a place that I wouldn't call it seedy, but it was difficult.
Did the circus in America bring the circus down? It's quite different, obviously, than the circus in Europe.
It didn't bring it down. I mean, it's what brought the circus down was technology, right? It was the fact that you had this art form that was a live piece of theater, and that as technology developed, as cinema developed, radio, television, it became harder and harder economically for that kind of art form to exist. One of the contrasts might be vaudeville. right? Like vaudeville died. Like, vaudeville is completely gone. But it wasn't because vaudeville got seedy or because the American vaudeville brought it down or anything. It was simply because it became really hard to produce a vaudeville show when a person could pay, you know, a dime or a nickel to go see a piece of cinema that you produce once.
Where did the three-ring circus come from? The circus in Europe, as I recall and as I remember and have heard, is a one-ring circus. Here, typically three rings.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I have a historical mentor, Pascal Jacob, who likes to say that you can actually watch the circus grow with America. So when the circus arrives in America in the late 18th century, it's a one-ring circus. The first circus was actually in Philadelphia. It was in a building the way it happened in Europe. And then as the circus moved out west, it began to grow. What allowed this three-ring circus to grow was actually – or to come into being was actually the existence of the tent. One of the things we think about circuses being, you know, in the tent, this itinerant art form. Mm-hmm. But for the first maybe 75 years of the form, it wasn't like that at all. It was actually in a building. So you would install a circus in a building or in a field. But there wasn't the idea of traveling. In America, what they realized was that you had this country that was growing so fast. You had people that were forging out into the wilderness, creating new societies, right? And they were desperate for entertainment. And the circus, because it was nonverbal, right, because it was physical, because there was a kind of physicality to it already. There were horses. It was used to performing on the ground. Right, could go out to those communities, and as a result, the tent was created. Once you have a tent, that then allows you to grow. Right, because in a building you can't have a two-ring circus because you have to tear down the building and build a new building. In a tent, if you have too many people, you can create a new tent the next year, and the next year, and the next year.
When did it change from the kinds of acts that you're talking about, and certainly the kind of acts that they perform in Europe, to something of a freak show?
That developed. I mean, freak shows, such as we call them, or phenomenon, have been around for millennia. Right? There's always this notion of something other than ourselves, and you know, a human being, especially, who is other than us. I mean, imagine pre-science, that was considered, you know, otherworldly. The freak show, the way we came to associate that with the circus, happened in the late 19th century. In Europe, that sort of stayed in the fairgrounds, and so it didn't really get integrated. When they think of circus, they don't think of freaks. They think of everything else we associate with the circus, but not that. In America, it became in largely through P.T. Barnum, who was considered the big kind of the freak champion, and who made lots and lots of money on that. And then later in life, actually, when he was in his 60s, got involved in circus and combined the two.
When did the circus start? That's not phrased very well, but you know, there had to be a beginning, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
When and how?
Well, it's interesting because the circus did actually start. The circus arts, we don't know when they started. Those all go back thousands and thousands of years. There are records in the tombs of Egypt of jugglers. There are Chinese acrobats. There's a kind of mythological existence of that before written language. The circus itself, though, as a form, such as we sort of generally conceive of it, came about in 1768. A British cavalier named Philip Astley, who had been training in the army and learned to do kind of horse stunts, came to London, saw that there was something like an equestrian theater that was developing. Basically, men who were in the army who knew how to do these same horse stunts performing in a ring, right? This is the birth of the ring. He saw that form, decided that was more interesting than the army, wanted to be a star, a showbiz star more than he wanted to be a general, got involved in that. 2 years later, in 1770, combined that kind of those equestrian stunts with other performers from the fairgrounds, the other circus arts. And this was born, the circus.
Jugglers and high wire or trapeze acts being first and foremost among these?
There was no trapeze at that time. The trapeze, it's funny, the trapeze, they say, is one of the few art forms that actually originated in the circus. Everything else the circus just appropriated and sort of held captive for a while. Trapeze originated actually in the mid-19th century. But yeah, initially it was acrobats. It was wire walkers. There were even some kind of basic clown routines. It was Philip Astley falling off his horse and kind of getting kicked in the ground. And he was, you know, it was that kind of notion of the comic already.
The clown, again, I'm relying on my own history, as I recall, was brought into it all as a diversion, as other things were being prepared, or if there were an accident, for instance, the clown would divert attention.
Yeah, that was part of it. The clown, I mean, a clown, like, what is a clown, right? Like, why, like, what a weird character that clown is. And why is it, why does this weird character exist among these physical acts, right? There are many, many, many responses to that question. One of them is, as you're saying, like, the idea that you had between the physical acts, you had some time that you needed to kill. You, maybe you needed to bring in a new piece of equipment. The clown was great for kind of diverting attention, for entertaining the audience while you did that. There's also something about the notion of seeing a performer do something not as well as everybody else that humanizes the circus. So you can then, you know, you, if to see an extraordinary physical feat is amazing. To see somebody like yourself try an extraordinary physical feat and fail actually might bring it closer to you, might make it feel like a more of a participatory sport event. I think it's the other thing about the clown too. I would note is that when we look at a kind of traditional structure, circus structure, to see a virtuosic feat after another virtuosic feat, sort of in a line like that, is interesting. But maybe it's more interesting to see a kind of, you know, a character, or to see something fail, or to see something, you know, change the dynamic.
That is not to say that the clowns themselves are not without talent.
Oh no, and I mean, what they say is that actually that to be a clown, you have to at first master the discipline. Right, so if you're going to fall off a horse correctly, you have to know how to ride a horse and then actually know how to fall off it. But of course, the audience often doesn't know that. In traditional clowning, too, that's often revealed at the end of the bit. So you'll have the guy fall off the horse 3 or 4 times, and at the end, he'll, you know, stand on his head on the horse and be like, "Oh wow, like he could actually do that the whole time, and I didn't know."
Who's the most famous clown?
Who's the most famous clown? It really depends on the culture. One of the most famous clowns sort of worldwide is a clown named Grock from the early 20th century, who performed as much in music halls as he did in circus. He was really well known because he created a clown act that actually lasted upwards of, I think it was 50 minutes. And it was completely choreographed. And he created that act basically the way a contemporary artist would, which is a theme that is kind of emerging in contemporary circuses, of full shows based on single circus arts. And it would take up a full night at the music hall. And everything was sort of specific. The gestures were specifically choreographed, the words, every moment to create a piece of – basically a piece of theater.
Well, now we have to get into your own experiences with the circus as outlined in the book, although much of the book does deal with the history, the kind of things that we're talking about here. But the title is The Ordinary Acrobat. You, that's you, right? Tell us about that experience. I can't imagine climbing up that pole and being strapped in, no matter how glamorous the lady on the platform, and pushing me off.
Yeah, no, I mean, the book is really, it tries to tell the history, the history and the story of the circus, but it tells it through my experience. So I went to France. I had a Fulbright Fellowship after I'd kind of discovered the circus, which I went earlier. And I spent a year at the National Circus School there trying all the circus arts, so trying juggling, trying clowning, trying trapeze. I think the story you're referring to is the first time that I actually did the flying trapeze. There was a miscommunication because my French wasn't very good and because I was nervous. And somehow it got communicated to the people doing the trapeze that I had actually done it before. So when I get up there and they put me on the trapeze and send me off, normally you have what's called a safety belt, a kind of harness, and I didn't have that. And it became a comedic scene very quickly, which I recount in the book.
Was it a dangerous situation for you?
You know, was that dangerous? It's funny. I mean, France has different tort laws, right? So in France, just climbing ladders is more dangerous because there's a very thin mat at the bottom. And the ladder was a kind of like it looked like metal chopsticks strung between wire. So it was very kind of precarious. Once you're actually on the trapeze, it's less dangerous because you have the big net below you. That said, the net can obviously hurt you and there's certain ways to fall. But in that case, I think it was more just that, like, when you do the trapeze for the first time, it's a pretty exhilarating experience, extreme experience. And not knowing that I had something attached to me made it seem even more open and kind of I felt even more vulnerable.
You know, you mentioned the net, and the net can be dangerous. That is something I've always wondered about as I went to the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus as a kid in on the East Coast. And I worried as much about people falling on that net and hurting themselves as about any other part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. It absolutely happens. Yeah. To beginners, it doesn't happen. So I don't want, you know, listeners to think like, oh, like if I do the trapeze, I need to worry about falling in this, you know, the net. But if you're doing a triple backflip, you know, and if you are not exactly sure of where you are in space, or if you lose your orientation and you fall, you can absolutely, you know, fall wrong and fall on your neck. Or there's a famous famous trapezist named Alfredo Codona who talked about it being satanic. right? Because it could gouge your flesh, the rope. But he also spent many, 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 many years doing it without getting hurt in the net.
Who joins the circus today?
Who joins the circus? Everybody joins the circus. I mean, the ordinary acrobat in terms of the title is me, but it's also everybody. One of the big themes of the book and one of the things I really try to understand is the fact that the circus has changed both aesthetically, so artistically, and as a participatory activity. Just to give you an example, in 1973, there were zero circus schools in Western Europe, right? Zero. The circus was something that was handed down through families. The Soviet bloc had circus schools, but not in Europe. In 1974, two schools were created in Paris by actually old circus families combined with actors. From there, it sort of started to develop as an amateur movement. Today, France has over 650 circus schools. And again, this is think of France as like, just to give people a context, we think of it as France as having this big old history, but it's actually just the size of Texas, right, mm-hmm. physically. And so think of Texas having 650 circus schools. It's absolutely amazing. In America, we have the American Youth Circus Organization has 250 members. There are hundreds of other training programs around. The beauty of the circus now, as we understand it, is not – it's interesting. I mean, it used to be that the circus was like something that you saw and appreciated because it was strange and because it was unique, right? Now we understand that it's accessible, right? And a person can learn it. And so the values of it have become much different. It's much more about now physicality or creativity or performance or something that you can do yourself.
I asked who joins the circus primarily because it has always seemed to me that it was very much a family tradition, that you could go to any circus in the world and you'd find generations there, perhaps.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I mean, the thing that what's funny about the circus is we so associate that with the circus because that was so the case, right? But that also used to be the case with acting. It also used mm-hmm. to be the case with dance, right? For hundreds of years, your father would be an actor and you'd become an actor. It was the case with blacksmithing. It was the case with pretty much everything. Over time, these other forms basically left that model and took up a model of education. What's fascinating about the circus is it didn't, right? It stayed really in the family. And it was only in this, what I'm describing now, in the 70s and 80s, that the circus really came into itself and you began to have a notion of circus education and an infrastructure for that.
Well, we talk about circus schools. What is to be learned? I mean, do you learn every part of it? If you want to be a trapeze artist, you go to circus school to learn how to do that and to the exclusion perhaps of other things?
Yeah. Often you have to pick a specialty, right? Mm-hmm. And that specialty can be trapeze. It can be acro balance. It can be anything. It can be clowning. The school also, there are professional circus schools. So I teach at a professional circus school in Montreal, the National Circus School of Montreal. They give a student a degree. So when you say exclusion of other things, of course, you're not going to come out as an accountant, right? But you will come out having studied literature, having studied philosophy. The class that I teach is about kind of critical thinking and creative thinking, so you get that. Other schools are even more diverse. The school where I studied in France, at the French National School, the idea is really that they want to build you into an artist, right? It's kind of fascinating. It comes from this idea that the circus was an art form, but it didn't necessarily know how to create art, right? Because it was more artisanal. So when you create a new kind of circus, how do you teach people how to be creative in the circus? Well, you need to teach them how to be creative. Mm-hmm. So there they bring in cinematographers, they bring in sculptors, they bring in poets, and something like 100 different artists over the course of the year to work with the students, just to teach them how to have a message and how to convey themselves artistically.
So that's kind of the backstory, the story behind the story. I can't imagine too many people have any idea that all of this would be going on when they go to the circus.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think it speaks not just to the circus in general, but to the circus today. It's this beautiful combination of physicality, of expression, of worldliness, internationalism, environmentalism. There's so many values that are wrapped up into it. And that was – honestly, the book was not something I ever intended to do. Like I initially went to circus school thinking, oh, it'd be fun to go to circus school. And if a Fulbright took me, that'd be great. But what I discovered so captivated me and I felt such the need to express it to others, especially people I knew in America who were unaware, as I was unaware, that it became hundreds of pages.
Did people still run away to join the circus?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, what's funny is it's two things. One is you don't have to run away, right? Don could go out tomorrow and take a trapeze class. Like, we could do that tomorrow.
No, I couldn't.
Yeah, I think you could. Like, no. it's funny, actually. I'm doing a series of events around the country to promote the contemporary circus in the book. And we had a 72-year-old aerialist perform at our event in Philadelphia. And she was fantastic. And she got the biggest applause of the night. Literally anybody can engage in the circus arts in a way. In terms of running away to the circus, yeah, there is still that notion of, people getting wrapped up in it. Like, that's one of the things that's blown me away, is that I keep encountering people who have found in the circus something that really touched them, and I don't want to say abandon their lives, but found themselves throwing themselves into it fully.
That's you.
It might be me. Yeah, it might be me. I think the only reason I resist that is because I feel like I don't want people to think that I'm any different than anybody else. Like, I'm still the guy from Clayton, right? I'm still somebody who, on the weekends, I go to movies with my friends and we talk about books and we hang out. Like, we go to the bar. I mean, there really is a sense that, you know, it doesn't like the circus takes you the way it used to. You can have the circus and you can have a regular life.
Are we going through something of a renaissance, a circus renaissance in this country today?
Absolutely. I mean, unquestionably. The sort of concrete statistics is the American Youth Circus Organization is adding dozens of members every year. We're in the beginning of forming a kind of circus infrastructure. There are new companies emerging. You're starting to see things like in New York, actually, a show came down from Montreal called Traces, which is a contemporary circus, played for 7 months, did gangbusters business. Now they're traveling around the country. What we're working on now in America is how to help that renaissance and how to give it a form. Part of the difficulty in America is there's not as much arts funding as there is in Europe. So for the last 30 years, the circus has boomed with that arts funding because it's been recognized as we recognize, say, ballet or opera, whereas here that's much harder. So people have been working really, really hard, but they've been doing it mostly grassroots.
And those same distractions that you talked about earlier, such as television, for instance, and other forms of entertainment, probably make that a much more difficult task.
It's still around, yeah, yeah. I think what's beautiful, though, is we're in this, and this is me sort of, this is not in the book, and instead of kind of just what I think, is that we're in a beautiful time when people are reengaging with their bodies and they're reengaging with community. And the circus is all about physicality, right? It's all about being present physically, and it's also about being involved in the community. One of the beautiful things about when you go to a circus show is you don't just, like, if you think of a theater show, you go and you look at a stage and you're sitting in the dark. In a circus show, you're sitting in a circle, right? The other people also make up part of the decor. You're looking at them. You're engaging in something physically. It's a ring, right? It's a community thing. And that's also true in the circus in terms of doing the circus. There's an experience that comes from the circus that is communal and that is participatory in a way that I think, you know, in the same way that, like in St. Louis, you're seeing people move downtown. You're seeing people kind of get closer to each other. I think that participates in that.
I wonder how many people involved in the circus a generation ago might have thought that something like the Cirque du Soleil would be the biggest act in Las Vegas, and it is year in and year out.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's Cirque is the kind of best example of just of the power of the circus still in the world. The fact that, like, this art form was diminishing, right? People thought it was going to go away. Like, there was really this fear that it would go the way of vaudeville. And now Cirque is a $1 billion-a-year business. I love it. They sell more tickets annually than all of Broadway combined, right?
Incredible.
And that's just one art. That's the circus, right? And so and what is it about this art form that still allows it to hold such power for people? It's something I explore in the book, and I still think it's an open question. But it's clear that it works.
How familiar are you with what's going on in St. Louis? I mean, I know you know about the circus floor. Yeah. Before going on air, we talked about Jessica Hentoff and what she is doing.
Yep.
What do you make of what's going on here?
I think it's great. I mean, it's interesting. We, in these events, it's part of an organization called Circus Now, which is trying to promote the contemporary circus and the circus in general around America. We set up events in 7 cities. We knew that in New York, there are, you know, dozens and dozens of organizations. In St. Louis, I knew of maybe 3 or 4. In putting the event together, though, I discovered about 6 more. So we have tonight, we have the St. Louis Hoop Club is performing. We have Tom Brady from Satori, who does kind of physical circus-based movement, is speaking about his work. We have somebody from a juggling teacher who works with Circus Harmony, which is Jessica Hentoff's organization, which, for the record, does what's called social circus, which is helping teach youth self-esteem and community building through the circus. And then she's, I mean, iconic in America and for her work there. Richard Keniston is a juggling teacher. He's talking about contemporary juggling. So it really was this notion of, you know, actually the Washington University Juggling Club is going to come. It's happening all over in so many different ways. And it was exciting for me to come back to St. Louis and say, oh, wow, this thing that I'm really passionate about is happening here. And it's happening at a much more diverse and integrated level than I expected.
Where do you expect the circus world to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
10 years from now. I think it's only going to continue to grow. It's absolutely booming. I hope in America we have a more developed infrastructure. So I hope there's something like a circus, a national circus network. I hope there's a sense of national community. I'd love to see some American companies that are really well-known, contemporary companies that are really well-known. I think that's happening. They're being born right now. It's even interesting in going around the country and talking to people. There's a sense of, oh, wow, like, you know, no, yeah. I mean, I did an event in Chicago, and now they're talking about creating a contemporary circus festival, right, where that's kind of been confirmed. And there are people saying, look, like, you know this person, let's get together and create something because we're all here and we can do this.
And where do you expect Duncan Wall to be 5, 10 years?
That's a much better
question.
That's a much more interesting question. I honestly don't know. I really hope to be a part of all of that that I just described. I'm also a writer, so it's sort of this beautiful dual thing that I can continue to explore as well.
So hopefully you'll be selling books 5 or 10 years from now, among other things.
I hope I'm still selling this book 5 or 10 years from now too, yeah.
And this book is The Ordinary Acrobat. The author, Duncan Wall, has been our guest in studio. Thanks so much for being with us, and best of luck to you and the book.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Join host Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape as he talks with actor and retired professional bodybuilder Lou Ferrigno, who appears this week at the St. Louis Comic-Con with Spanish classical guitarist Rafael Aguirre, and with the cast member and the choreographer and director of A Chorus Line. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll see you then, as usual, at 11. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.